of Deborah Sackerson versus City of Gilbert at file numbers A20-0343. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals at this virtual oral argument. And counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral argument this morning. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument. And for anyone who has joined us remotely, please be advised that it's against our rules to film these proceedings. However, this argument will be online and available, so you don't have to film it. But you are welcome to certainly listen and sit in on this. With that being said, the appellant may now proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. And before I proceed, can everyone hear me all right?
Yes.
All right, thank you. And good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Sean Reed, and I represent the appellant, Deb Sackerson, in this appeal. Ms. Sackerson is the former clerk treasurer for the City of Gilbert, who was terminated on July 17, 2018. This appeal comes before the court from a summary judgment on plaintiff's action alleging violations of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and claims of defamation. The standard of review for this court here today on the issues is de novo. This court must determine whether there are genuine issues of material fact and whether the district court erred in its application of the law. Now, I'm going to jump straight into the argument this morning. I believe the facts are fairly straightforward.
And do you agree that the facts are undisputed?
I believe so, Your Honor. This is our position here is that the court erred as a matter of law in this
matter.
Okay,
thank you. I gathered that. I just want to clarify. Thank you.
Certainly. I'm going to focus primarily today, given the limitation of time, on the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, as the analysis is similar between that and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And then if there's time, I'll touch on the defamation. But that's where I want to focus this morning. Your Honor, the court's well aware that the Minnesota Whistleblower Act prohibits an employer from discharging or discriminating against employee for quote-unquote whistleblowing. That statute set out at 181, 931, and 932. In this case, we're focusing on clauses 1 and 3 of Minnesota Statute Section 181, 932, which essentially prohibits an employer from discriminating an employee who in good faith reports a violation, a suspected violation or planned violation of any law to a government body or a law enforcement official. And clause 3, and I think this is the one we want to focus on primarily, refuses an employer's order to perform an action that the employee has an objective basis, in fact, that violates any state, federal rule or regulation. And so the analysis that we apply in this case is the McDonnell-Douglas analysis because there is no direct evidence in this case. So we're focusing on the burden shifting framework that the court's well aware of. In order to establish the prima facie case of retaliation, the appellant must show that she engaged in statutorily protected conduct.
Counsel, can we talk about her conduct?
Yes.
So I have the statute in front of me, and it's my understanding that I'm going to put aside the allegation that's not alleged in the complaint, but let's talk about the first issue, which is she canceled a meeting, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And go ahead.
So under 181.932 subdivision 1.3, that references the employee refuses an employer's order to perform an action. How is the cancellation of a meeting a refusal to perform an action? Well, she actually acted, right, by canceling the meeting.
She did act, and to be clear, this goes back to the December 2016 issue. There was a meeting that was arranged between Stantec, which was a city contractor relating to a wastewater project.
Right, I'm familiar with the facts.
Gotcha. And so Ms. Sackerson did act in that case, and her action was directed at advising Stantec that the individual city councilor had no authority to arrange that meeting at that time. Further, she noted that the mayor and the city council didn't direct that.
But what I'm looking at is the plain language of the statute, because we're talking about a matter of statutory interpretation.
Yes.
And I think we all agree that this statute is unambiguous.
I believe that's a correct statement, Your Honor.
So then we apply its plain meaning, and the plain meaning is the employee refuses an employer's order to perform an action. So my question to you is, how is the cancellation, the affirmative act of canceling a meeting, qualify as the employee refusing an employer's order?
Well, in this case, we have to look at the context of her job. She was a city clerk treasurer. One of her obligations was to organize those meetings. In this case, she told the other outside meeting individual, Stantec, that the meeting was not proper because of the fact that it wasn't requested by the city council as a whole, and that the parties that were requesting it had not yet been sworn into office. And in her view, that violated Minnesota Statute 358.05, which specifically states that before transacting any business or exercising any privilege of the office, those officers needed to be sworn in. And at the
I don't have any doubt that she acted in good faith in accordance with what she believed the law to be. My question is really precise about the statute, though, about what she did.
Sure.
So how, well, I just don't understand, just as a matter of statutory interpretation, how her affirmative action can qualify as a refusal to perform an act.
Well, again, if you look at the role that she plays, she's a city clerk treasurer. She's responsible for organizing, maintaining those meetings. She contacted the other person and put them on notice of the inappropriateness of the meeting. And if we look at the, if the court's familiar with the testimony that was provided, Mayor Milos even takes the position that Deborah Sackerson actually canceled that meeting. So that's the action, and that in doing that action, that's tantamount to a refusal to perform that improper action.
But is there any evidence in the record that someone ordered her to do that from the city? That someone ordered her to do anything with regard to these meetings?
No, I would agree with the court that there is no direct evidence of a direct order. However, this falls within her job duties as the secretary, as the clerk treasurer managing these meetings.
And I just want to be clear, when you say this falls within her job description at the time, what specifically are you referring to? What is the this?
And thank you for that, Judge. And again, I don't have the specific job description in front of me. I believe it's part of the record. When I'm arguing before the court today, I'm speaking in general terms based off of my experience in dealing with other city clerks and treasurers, what their common duties are. I don't have the specific job description in front of me. Does that answer that question?
No, I guess I'm wondering what the duty that you're referring to would be here.
Well, I guess in terms of operating as the clerk, she's responsible for posting meetings, providing notice for all the meetings, so on and so forth. That falls clearly within her wheelhouse, so to speak, of what she is expected to do. Now, this meeting was requested. It went outside the scope of the statutory authority of those new officers that had not yet been sworn in. And further, I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. So I'll finish that sentence there. So clearly, that was one of the issues. That's only one of the issues in this case that we allege was a direct order. Perhaps if I can jump ahead to the other incident, which was on December of 2017. Now, that one has a very clear, and perhaps that's the clearer position to take. That's the issue with respect to the health insurance. The statute clearly states that health insurance related to collective bargaining units cannot be changed basically without their participation or agreement. Law is clear on that. There is a specific email in the record. I believe it was from Councilor Robich, dated December 1st, 2017. We cite that in my brief, where Ms. Ackerson advised Councilor Robich that there are collective bargaining agreements. You cannot just go and change the insurances. Councilor Robich said something to the effect of, I understand there are collective bargaining agreements, follow up with this other insurance company. I think it was Great Minnesota or Great Northwestern or something like that.
And Council, with regard to this incident, is it your claim that Ms. Ackerson's conduct amounted to a report under the statute under subdivision 1-1 or a refusal under subdivision 1-3? Which of the two?
Under 1-3, Your Honor. Because I believe that our theory of the case is that email was an order for her to perform an action.
How is the research of health insurance illegal?
Well, I don't think it's the research is not illegal in and of itself. You have to look at the case in the context of the history of the parties and the timing of it. I believe the parties, the counselors that came in, their primary mission was to reduce budgets across the board. And this was coming in, if you look at the status of the facts, was coming in late. So I think the facts support that was more than just research. This was, you will do this. We're looking at it, we're reducing the rates.
When you say do this, what is the this that she was asked to do that was illegal?
Follow up with the Great Northern Insurance Company.
So that's where, that really is my question, Council. I understand that what she thought was ultimately going to happen may have been illegal, but the specific directive to her to engage in research in anticipation of a future action, I'm not sure that that qualifies as asking her to do something that's a violation of a law.
And I understand your point, Your Honor. And I guess the only thing I can say in response to that, you have to look at the facts in the context of everything else that was happening.
I see that you're running down on time. I do want to ask you some questions about the allegations of pretext.
Certainly.
So when I read your brief and I read the record, I'm not sure exactly what facts you have identified that are evidence that the stated reasons for the termination were false and that they were really a pretext for age or gender discrimination. Can you be specific with what facts you are pointing to in the record and where they are in the record, please?
Yes, I can do that. And thank you for the question, Your Honor. First of all, we take the position that for the pretext here, there were shifting reasons in the termination. Now, the court's aware that that my client underwent an investigation in April, and that enumerated 11 or so issues, some of which were found were unsubstantiated, and a couple were substantiated. Now, at the time of the termination meeting, the termination reasons changed.
Wasn't terminated until that meeting.
Correct.
Okay.
I believe that meeting was July 17th of 2018, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
So at that termination meeting, at that point in time, for the first time, I believe, she was newly accused of falsifying documents. And the best thing I can point out to would be that the meeting minutes for that. Secondly, we rely on the fact that there are shifting policies. There are no performance review was applied in this case, even though that's their policy. Likewise, much of this case revolved around my client's interaction with the former IT employee, Steve Peterson. And they took a great umbrage with the fact that my client had emailed some information to Mr. Peterson. Couple things and those emails are all in the record. I believe they're Exhibit AA, Exhibit EE, Exhibit FF, and GG. If the court looks at, starting with just with the emails, they say that she shared confidential information. And they cite to the record this Exhibit EE, which is an email from city's counsel to the city, which my client forwarded to Mr. Peterson, simply saying, FYI. And that.
So let's assume that all of that's true. Okay. So I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, and we'll assume that all of these reasons are shifting and potentially not the real reasons for her termination. What is the evidence that the real reason for her termination was her age or her gender? And where is that in the record?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me just state clearly today, she's 66. She's a female. And I think the court, the evidence of that is the fact that she was replaced by a younger man. My client was a certified public accountant. She was also a clerk treasurer at the city of Cohasset. She was replaced by this younger gentleman who has no experience as a city clerk, as a treasurer, or as an accountant. And I see that my time is running down. I don't know if that answered your question.
If you think of additional reasons why it's a pretext, you can elaborate in rebuttal.
I will do so, Your Honor.
Thank you
so much.
Okay. Morning, Your Honors. My name is Jessica Shui of Kennedy and Graven. I am representing the city of Gilbert in this matter. Opposing counsel focused plaintiff's argument on the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, and so I'll start there as well. It's important for the court to understand that the city did not challenge, for purposes of summary judgment, whether protected reports were made. That issue was
why not? I don't understand that.
It was a choice that we made, Your Honor, to not focus on that. We waived the argument on that. Opposing counsel or plaintiff did argue that on summary judgment that the reports were protected. We said, look, just for purposes of summary judgment, we'll assume that they're protected. It still does not establish a Minnesota whistleblower claim. The lower court chose to take up the reasoning of whether or not they were protected reports. So the court could reach that issue. As we noted in briefing, we're focusing still on our defenses, which is even if they are protected reports, there is an insufficiency of evidence on a causal connection. There's a legitimate reason for termination. That legitimate reason is not phony. And I still plan to focus my arguments on that orally here. I will take up the sufficiency of whether or not there are protective reports, but I'm going to focus, if you ask those questions, I'm going to focus my arguments on timing. Timing is noted in our briefing, both below and here. The way the claim was initially pled is that there was a protected report in December 2016 and another one in January 2017. It was also more specifically pled that the January 2017 conduct involved the oppositional conduct. Okay, that's how the case was pled. That's how it was litigated until summary judgment motion practice. For the first time and at that time is when plaintiff alleged a new basis for the oppositional conduct, which was a December 2017 alleged report in opposition related to this health insurance. The importance of that is this. When we went in on briefing, the city argued, look, if you take her complaint and you look at just those reports, assume that they're protected, it's a year and a half that passes before she's terminated. That's a year and a half of conduct, performance of job duties, and most importantly, a third-party neutral independent investigation into certain conduct that confirmed certain inappropriate conduct, misconduct, that served as a basis for termination on July 17th, 2018. It's a year and a half. As a matter of law, under the cases that we have cited before the court, that is insufficiently close and defeats a causal connection. And opposing it, plaintiff says, no, look, wait, I've got this December 2017 report. By doing that, what she did is she shortened the time frame to a 7.6 month spread. Even if you shorten that time frame, what I just said stands as true. During that 7.6 months, you still have independent conduct, performance of job duties, an independent investigation that reviewed conduct, found misconduct, reported it to the city council, and that served as the basis then in July 2018 for termination. Still as a matter of law, even with that shortened time frame, there is intervening, superseding conduct that breaks the causal connection and does not allow for a Minnesota whistleblower claim. Get past that, there's still a legitimate reason. There's an argument there that the legitimate reason Hastings' report is flawed. That's not the proper issue for this court. The question is, did the city put forth a reason for termination? The answer is yes. What was that reason? That she was hostile, unprofessional, lacking forthrightness is one of the primary reasons. Are there additional reasons? The answer is yes. I'll just focus on that one because it's a reason. It's all the city has to do is put that forth as a matter of law that establishes that there's a legitimate reason put forth. The next question then is the phony or pretext, and that's where the arguments just left off. Shifting reasons, departure from policy, and lack of documentation relating to the allegations addressed by Hastings. That's what was put forth by plaintiff as the basis for the city's reasons being phony. As the court just recently noted, what's the evidence of a real reason? This case does not include any discriminatory or retaliatory remarks. The plaintiff admitted that. There's no evidence of discriminatory or retaliatory remarks. As a matter of law—
Is there a question of fact though about whether the replacement of a 66-year-old woman with certain qualifications with a younger man with lesser qualifications, does that create a question of fact as to whether there is evidence of discrimination that would substantiate a pretext argument?
Okay, Your Honor, my answer would be no.
And why not?
It's twofold. One, using the Diaz case I was just going to cite that's referenced in our brief, first of all, you look at the fact that because there's an absence of discriminatory remarks, there's already the motivation is already undermined. So you're already at a lower hurdle. Then we look at the replacement concept. And by the way, replacement concept is not probative of the whistleblower claim, it's probative of the MHRA claim, which is age and gender. On that, as we put forth in our brief, as a matter of law, she was not replaced. The person—
Well, her duties were reassigned to him. So maybe it wasn't a one-for-one replacement, but the things that she was doing were given to somebody who is a white male who is younger than her.
Yes, but he was already working for the city in a different position and assumed her job duties. As a matter of law, under the Dietrich case, and the more recent unpublished case that reaffirms Dietrich, that's not a replacement. That's a new position. And it is a new position, economic development director / interim city clerk. It's not the position that she held. It's a new position. So as a matter of law, it's not a replacement. And that's why there's no question of fact. It's a legal issue at that point. The facts are just what I told you. And then when you apply the law to that under Dietrich and the unpublished case cited in our brief that reaffirms Dietrich, as a matter of law, it's not a replacement. So that goes to both then wrapping up the age and gender claims as well as the whistleblower claim. And real briefly, but coming back to the shifting reasons. The reasons that the city took up at the July 2018 meeting are before the court, but just to recap again, it adopted Christy Hastings' report. It did bring up, the city council did bring up the falsification of documents. That was one of the issues taken up by Christy Hastings in her report. And the city council revisited it because Christy Hastings ultimately concluded, hey, look, with regard to the falsification of documents, did she do this conduct? Yes, she did this conduct, but I'm not prepared to say that it was an intentional falsification because there appears to have been a miscommunication. That's not a new reason. It's a continuing discussion of a reason that was presented. So it's not a shifting reason. In lower, before the lower court and on this appeal, the additional basis for a shifting reason was that post termination, there's unemployment proceedings. Maribeth Milos goes to that unemployment hearing and testifies, okay, here's the reasons for termination, Chrissy Hastings' report, and for me, Ms. Sackerson's conduct surrounding the 2016 Stantec meeting. Again, that's not a new reason. That was part of Chrissy Hastings' report. It was actually part of the reason for termination because surrounding that meeting was Sackerson's unprofessional, hostile conduct. It was unprofessional to cancel that meeting without discussing it with anyone. That was the stated basis multiple times. It's not a shifting reason. The departure from policy is a red herring related to performance evaluations. That's right. The city didn't conduct performance evaluations. That was the policy. And the fact that it didn't conduct performance evaluations has no relevancy or bearing on the termination decision, which came after this process that we've talked about with Chrissy Hastings' report and taking that up. And then, to the lack of documentation, I mean, Chrissy Hastings' report collected a vast amount of evidence. There's including testimonial evidence from persons that were interviewed, as well as documentary evidence. So there was adequate documentation supporting the reasons for termination in a way that renders, it takes it out of the phony context as a matter of law. So that brings us to the defamation claim then. So the discrimination claims, whistleblower claims should both, the dismissal on those claims should be affirmed. The defamation claim then that remains, that the dismissal of that should also be affirmed. As more fully set forth in my brief to the court, or defendant's brief to the court, there's four statements. One statement that Sackerson's contract was criminal. She was on an unemployment contract. And then there's three statements that are all taken close in time together, and they relate to statements made at the July 2018 meeting. Just to step back on the first statement, contract criminal, that statement was made by Beth Milos in her capacity as a private citizen getting ready to run for candidate as a mayor. It was made at an open meeting by a private citizen. Conduct is not attributable to the city. City can't be held liable for defamation on that. So then we go to the three comments that are made at the city council meeting surrounding her termination. As set forth in our brief, first of all, it's not defamation. Our position is that it's true, but more importantly, those statements are privileged. Now, the statements were made at the city council meeting, and then they were also made to a reporter. A reporter was there, plus there was some communication after, and it's published. Whether the statements were made at the city council meeting or subsequently to the reporter and then published, each of those are privileged because of the public doctrine, public official doctrine.
Why are the statements to the press outside of the formality of the meeting cloaked in privilege?
They're still cloaked in privilege because they address matters of public concern and also address matters of a public official. And so this is different than the Carradine.
You're alleging that they made their statements in their official capacity?
They did make their statements in their official capacity, but they also made them about a person in her official capacity and about issues that are matters of public concern. So this takes it out of, because what I hear Your Honor referring to is the Carradine case. It takes the situation out of the Carradine case and makes it much more like, I believe it's the Letterman versus Redwood County case. We're talking about matters of public concern. That's why I briefed this a little bit differently, because you got the three privileges applying, which is a little bit different. In any one of those, malice becomes the question. And there is insufficient evidence of malice. not only is there, I would argue that the higher burden of malice applies here, actual malice, but you don't even get to common law malice on the statements. There is simply no evidence in the record before the court of personal spite, which is the necessary level of evidence to establish and defeat the privileges that would apply here. I see that my time is coming to an end. Again, I would request that the defamation be affirmed, and I'd like to leave a little time for any further questions that the court may have.
Judge Hooten, it looks like you're talking, but your mute button is on.
Judge Hooten, we can't hear you.
Now, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
All right, let's circle back to the whether Ms. Sackerson's conduct was protected.
Okay.
Conduct. And since you did not address that,
yes,
in the summary judgment matter, is it appropriate for us to consider that on a?
We can hear you.
Can everyone hear?
I can, Your Honor, and I can repeat the portion of the question that I heard, which is it appropriate for the court at this juncture to take up the issue of the propriety of the report? And I see you nodding your head, yes. The answer is, as a technical matter, under Thiel versus Stitch, the answer is yes, the court can take it up, because under Thiel versus Stitch, the court can take up anything that was ruled upon by the court below, okay? So yes, you could take it up. I'm still going to, on behalf of the city, maintain our position that we're not putting forth an argument that the reports were not protected. The court can take it up on its own and rule as it wishes. We brought our and seek affirmance on the fact that there was intervening conduct that broke the causal connection, as well as legitimate non-phony reason.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Reid, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
I'm sorry about that, Your Honor. I clicked the button and everyone disappeared for a second. My apologies. And perhaps if I can circle back around to Judge Frisch's question when I wrapped up my primary argument. What other evidence of pretext is there in this case? And primarily, our source of the pretext is to go for what the stated reasons were, and that was the special minutes specifically articulated that my client requested to Mr. Peterson to change and recreate records to be refiled. The emails forwarded sharing attorney-client privilege information to an ex-employee, and the continuing leaking of information. Those were the articulated reasons. Now, what we tried to do in our brief was then to go behind those articulated reasons and see what there actually was to support them. And quite frankly, our position is there is very little or absolutely nothing to support that. Starting with the first proffered reason, the request to change and recreate records, that they were referring to an email dated February 15th from my client to Mr. Peterson that appears as Exhibit AA in the record. And simply all that email said was attached is a 2016 mileage log with your 2016 reimbursement request.
But Mr. Reid, I'm getting a little feedback here. I appreciate that there's an allegation that the stated reasons were false, but pretext requires two things. It requires, number one, that the stated reasons are false. And I don't have any questions about your position there, but it requires something else. And that is the real reason for the termination was discrimination or retaliation, right? Sure. So that's what my question's about. What's the evidence of the real reason? And I understand your position that replacement of her duties by, you know, with somebody who is of a different gender and who is younger than her is indicative of discriminatory intent. Is there anything else? That's my question to you.
Thank you. And thank you for that clarification. So we're focusing basically on that second prong there.
Yes.
Okay. I appreciate the clarification. And what I would say is direct the court to the specific testimony that is cited from Mayor Milos during the course of the unemployment law hearing. It's during that hearing that she testified about the StanTech meeting, testified about the fact that there's simply complete lack of policies. We're talking about the mileage policy, talking about the email policy. They're simply not there. And everything all ties back to the StanTech meeting. And if I can just use that to kind of segue into the timing issue, the court, when it issued its decision on this, it really focused on the causal connection. It really focused on just the issue of timing and basically took the blanket position that say, well, listen, there's almost 2 months, or I'm sorry, not 2 months, 2 years, or I forget, 24 months of time period between the StanTech and the firing. So the causal connection is 2 weeks. It's our position the court did not look beyond that. And obviously we cite case law in our brief stating that the timing element's all over the place. Some cases it says that 5 months is too short. Some cases say 20 months is okay. So there is no bright line rule. So what we have to do and what the fact finder needs to do in these cases, is they need to go behind the timing and look at what's actually happening. And in this case, had the court looked closer at Mayor Milo's testimony during the unemployment law hearing, it would have seen that everything ties back and that StanTech meeting kind of follows Ms. Sackerson throughout this whole journey. So this time factor of, I think, what the 24 months, it's really not that. So again, to wrap back around to your question, Judge Frisch, the evidence that I would point you to would be Mayor Milos's own testimony, sworn testimony. And I see that my time is about to run out. I would just ask if there's any other questions that I can address at this point in time.
Just really briefly, Mr. Reed, can you respond to respondents' argument here that there was no actual replacement, given the fact that this person who took over Ms. Sackerson's responsibilities was already working in another capacity for the city?
Sure, and thank you for that. I do concede that he has not, to my knowledge, taken up the title of city clerk treasurer. However, that's a label. He did take over and assume her duties. I would also point to the record and point to the briefing. Once he took over those duties, they treated him differently. They changed the hours of operation. Closing the city hall over the noon hour, that's something that did not happen for my client. And you might be asking, well, what's the big deal about that? When you're looking at the record, you can tell that there was a lot of work trying to get done in City Hall, and keeping the City Hall open during those hours put my client at a detriment with this younger man that came on who got the City Hall closed, treated him differently.
All right, thank you very much. I think your time is has expired, and we will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory period of time. Thank you both for your very, very good oral argument.